From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Thank you, Brandy Morris and Joelle, for supporting me and this podcast by making a pledge at my Patreon page. Do you want to hear your name here at the top of the show? Are you enjoying this podcast and would like to help me make more episodes? Then head over to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. It means a great deal to me and you will get to headline the show just like Brandy and Joelle did today. Welcome to episode number 117, part 2 of my conversation with Amber O'Hearn. Amber has been studying and experimenting with ketogenic diets since 1997 and has eaten a plant-free diet since 2009 after discovering its profound effects on her mood and cognition. She has presented at various conferences on the role of ketosis and meat eating in brain development and evolution. Her review on the evolutionary appropriateness and benefit of weaning babies onto a meat-based, high-fat, low-carb diet was included as testimony defending Professor Tim Noakes in his recent trial. She is a data scientist by profession, with prior publications in mathematics, linguistics, and psychology. She is also the founder and organizer of the fantastic carnivore conference, CarnivoryCon. This year, it will be held on the weekend of May 23rd and 24th, and you can find out more about the speaker lineup and get your tickets at carnivorycon.com. Enough of my intro ramblings, let's get back to my conversation with Amber. I think it would be interesting. I know this is something that you spoke about at Keto Fest, and it's this whole difference between scientific studies being the pinnacle of what we should be looking at for what is right and what is wrong versus anecdotal data. We were talking about this a bit before we started, and it goes round and round depending which way you're looking at it. And, you know, we hear all the time, don't you, that we need the scientific studies are the gold standard. That's what we need. That's the data we need. and we can't rely on anecdotal data. Yeah, it's often the anecdotal, it's the experience, it's the talking to people about their own experience that not only inspires us to do something, but shows us what can be done with eating a certain way or whatever it is you're looking at. I know you have quite a few opinions on this. I'd like to hear a bit more from you about it, because I think, well, you put it much better than I do, but I've seen you comment a few times about how studies obviously have their usefulness, but if they're completely different from your own experience, they're kind of no use to you at all. It's no use to tell you something is one way if your experience tells you it's the opposite.
Yeah, thanks for asking me about that, because it is a topic I really, really like. Anecdotes are sometimes considered dangerous because if there's a fairly robust effect, but there are a lot of complicated factors. Like, for example, a lot of people are pretty persuaded that cigarette smoking is a causal factor in lung cancer. And there are always going to be some people who live for a really long time, even though they smoke a lot. And so that's the kind of anecdote that people get really upset about. They're saying, well, just because, you know, this one person was really lucky doesn't mean that you can apply that to everyone. And I certainly would agree with that. But on the other hand, all science starts with an observation of something that seems surprising based on what you already believe. And what you already believe could even be based on studies. So there could be tons of studies saying that or suggesting highly or supporting in some way some model that you have, like carbohydrates are necessary for the brain, like eating carbohydrates are necessary for the brain. But all it really takes is one person to not eat carbohydrates and not die to show yeah. that part of the model has to obviously be false, right? So there's a certain sense in which it really doesn't matter how many studies are supporting an idea. If your observation is in frank contradiction to it, then you have to believe your observation and you have to realize that there's some breakdown somewhere. There's some assumption in the studies that doesn't apply to you or something. You have to believe your observations. Another point that I like to talk about when it comes to anecdotes has to do with risk versus reward. So someone might say, you can't try a low-carb diet for weight loss because all of the effectiveness is just based on anecdotes and it's never been proven to work. Well, why does it matter if it's not proven? Because the cost to try it is essentially nothing. Like, I can try it. I can spend 3 weeks trying a ketogenic diet and see if it causes weight loss. And it has absolutely no bearing whether it's ever been sufficiently proven that it's going to cause weight loss or not cause weight loss, because it's so easy for me to try and the risks are so low, I might as well. Whereas if it were like, I don't know, swallow this really expensive medicine that has a whole bunch of side effects because there's a small chance that it might solve your complicated medical issue, that's a completely different ballgame. Then you want a whole lot of studies that really prove to a very strong degree that it's going to be safe and that it's going to be effective. Because if it's either not safe or it's moderately safe, but the chance that it's going to actually help you is low, then why bother doing it? Mm. I think it's a real mistake to brush anecdotes with this one wide brush when the context has so much of a bearing on whether an anecdote is something that you should use to guide your own experience or not.
Yes, and I just don't like this whole dismissing people's experience because it doesn't fit with these scientific studies that have proven something. I get very unscientific when I get into these conversations because I just feel very stabby. And I cannot bear somebody trying to tell me they know my body better than I do. They know what I should be feeling. They know all this because there's a study that says it's so. you simply can't dismiss somebody's experience, or you can't say, well, you're having that experience because of such and such. It doesn't fit these studies that prove what I'm saying, my theory, to be the case. And so that it just gets dismissed in some way. I can't stand it. It's just, I so strongly believe in validating people's experience, because that's all they have. And that's what is the most important to the individual. It doesn't matter what you're being told. What works for you? And I know it's very unscientific to say, do what works for you. But that ultimately is going to be what's going to give you the best success.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the problems that I think people have in mind when they say studies show it's going to have this effect, so it can't be having this effect in you. What's the best case sort of scenario to support that idea? You'd have to imagine that the person either has made a mistake because they weren't being vigorous enough, like there are other variables that they weren't taking into account. And that can certainly happen. I think that once we get our minds fixed on an idea that some X is causing us a problem or that we need to do X, it can be easy to ignore other variables that may be coming into play. So there's a certain fairness about that. Then the other one that I keep going back and forth on and haven't really decided what I think about is the idea of a placebo effect. So suppose I've got it into my head that I can't stop eating nuts or that nuts cause me weight gain. Is it possible that it's that idea in my mind that's somehow causing that effect? And that if I would stop believing it, the effect wouldn't happen. Mm. And I don't know. I think the mind is a powerful thing, but I don't know. Some people have actually suggested there's several papers in the literature arguing that the placebo effect actually isn't even a real thing. It's actually just the random variation that can account for a placebo effect and also regression to the mean. So if you have a whole bunch of sick people and you give some of them a placebo and some of them a treatment, and the people with the placebo all get slightly better, and then the treatment, you're supposed to compare it to how much better the people on the placebo got. But so they call that getting a bit better, they call that a placebo. And I think what a lot of people have in mind is that people believed so hard that they were getting a treatment that they caused it to happen, which is really an astounding thing to say. So the people who are arguing against this say, well, all of those people who are in this trial were at their peak level of disease, and it's just statistically extremely likely that they're going to get slightly better because they were as bad as they could get. And so that's regression to the mean. But if you're going to believe that your body can have a healing effect on you, then I think, wouldn't that be fascinating? Like, to the degree that that can be what's actually happening, I think we should, if we're going to say something like that, then we should give it seriousness and say, well, actually, if not eating nuts, or say, for my example, like, say, the reason that my bipolar disorder has gone into complete remission for like 10 years while not eating plants is because I have a really strong belief about the effect of plants on my mood. Well, who cares? Like, at some level, right? Like, if that's what it takes, then fine. I mean, it's not that bad. It would be really interesting if that were the case, because that says a whole lot about psychology that I think that if it were the case, we could really benefit from knowing. Because then we want to know what kind of treatment has the property that it can bootstrap this special property of the mind. So I don't know. I feel like if you're going to say that someone's observation about what works for them comes down to a placebo effect, then I think that opens up a whole can of worms that maybe they didn't intend to open.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because it is one of those phrases, placebo effect. And I suppose the opposite to that is that, you know, you can think yourself into a problem. Well, I say the opposite. It's the same thing. It's what you've just been saying. But I'm just thinking of my own experience with how I could think myself into a headache or a migraine. If there were a certain line of things in place, if all the migraine ducks were in a row, I could guarantee I was going to get a migraine. And this is, you know, going back to the point where I was getting them far, far more frequently. I could guarantee pretty much that if I was stuck in a car with someone who had perfume on, I was going to get out of that car with a migraine.
Mm-hmm.
But then you do start, it does start becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I know I've probably taught myself into a migraine many a time because I've just thought to myself, well, these circumstances are in place, I'm going to get a migraine.
It's hard to test something like that.
And I do. It's very hard to test, isn't it? And I think partly the thing with that, Elena Gross talked about the migraine bucket, and there's no sort of one cause for a migraine. There are all these different triggers. And it's when your bucket becomes so full that it spills over, and that's when a migraine happens. And there are things that fill that bucket far more quickly, like not getting enough sleep. For me, not eating keto. So if I'm eating a high carbohydrate diet, the bucket is already half full.
Right.
And then if I'm not sleeping properly, you know, and it can add another quarter to that. And then you'll just tip it over with that perfume. But the smelling perfume is like 2% or something.
Right.
But it's what flips you over. It's what makes the bucket spill over. But it's interesting. And yet, so if you drop that bucket down so that you're less vulnerable to it, then I could get in a car with someone who had perfume on and I wouldn't get migraine.
Right.
But it is interesting, isn't it? Just this whole how you can think yourself into a problem and how you could potentially think yourself out of one. I don't know. It's tricky, isn't it? But it's interesting that you brought that up, that the whole placebo effect is potentially not what we think it is.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
You can go round and round in circles on these things, can't you?
Mm-hmm.
And drive yourself a bit nuts. But what it comes down to is if you have a certain experience with something, you need to look at that.
Absolutely. You have to take yourself seriously because no study can cover all possibilities and no study is going to cover every person's experience in every possible context. And so you should never discount your own experience.
And that's what I like actually about when somebody does find something that works for them, they stop doubting themselves quite so much and start picking up some, you know, getting some confidence back. I can remember seeing that with April, just this constant being knocked down because she kept trying things that people said were going to work. Well, this is going to work. This is what you need to do because this works. Eating less fat, eating less calories. This has to work. This is the theory. It's set in stone. It's got to work. But then, of course, when it doesn't work for you, how do you deal with that? Do you say, well, you're all wrong. All you people out there who are telling me this is the way it's going to work, you're all wrong. And it's me. Now, what's more likely is you're going to say, yeah, well, it's me, isn't it? I've done it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done it exactly how you told me to. Or there's something broken in me that it's not working properly. But then when they stumble across something, just one person comes along, Siobhan comes along, hey, why don't you try this? And then all of a sudden, wow, this works. Starts gaining confidence, starting to be able to say, actually, no, you are all wrong. And this is what works because it's working. I'm getting the results.
Right.
I see that, just see that so much with keto. You know, I've felt it myself, but I see it with other people. Just gaining that confidence to be able to stand up for themselves.
It's a wonderful feeling once, you know, once something does start to work for you, even if it's not perfect or you're certainly, most people hit bumps in the road later, even with things that do work well. But I don't know, it's like watching a child learn to do something with motor control or with walking or something. The gaining of competence is just so important to one's feeling of well-being and self-worth, really.
Mm.
When you feel like you don't have control of your life, it's a terrible feeling.
Mm. And talking about anecdotal evidence, you know that I tried my own carnivore challenge and I was really fired up for it. I'd just been to Low Carb Denver and to your Carnivory Con. So I'd been surrounded by all this carnivore stuff. And that was it. I was going to come home and I was going to try a 90-day carnivore challenge. It was going to be really strict. It was just meat and salt and water. We'd also discussed it. It was an interview we'd done and we were having that interesting conversation about drinking too much.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember?
Absolutely.
And so that was part of my challenge. So I was only going to drink water. Mm-hmm. And actually, that was the thing that I struggled with most. I found that really, really hard. Well, the two things. One was the giving up butter because I wanted it very strict. So I wasn't allowed any dairy, which included the butter. I found that very difficult. But also the not having the coffee and the tea, I found that really hard. I had to actually drink boiled water, having it hot quite a lot of the time to try and get over that. That was the thing I found the most difficult. But I thought that it was going to work really well.
Yeah.
Because I'd seen all these other people having great results. And actually because I'd been leaning that way anyway, eating not mostly, but heading towards. Often most of my meals were carnivore. Breakfast is always, and dinner was often just that way. So I thought, well, it's just going to be more of a good thing.
Right.
And it's going to be great. So I had high expectations. I went in with that bias that it might be going to be a bit hard, but that it was going to go the same way I'd seen it go with so many other people, including you and Siobhan. But it really didn't. I had lots of problems and I spoke to you a bit about it at the time. We did actually solve the eye tremor. I had an eye tremor and we figured out that that was magnesium. That did help with that. Although interestingly, that's come back a bit recently. Mm. And this time it can't be magnesium because I've been taking loads. But anyway, that resolved. But I had dreadful reflux all the time. I was getting headaches again. And my mood absolutely tanked. It's what kind of sort of started off the problems I've had with depression this year. So it's what started it. And it's only really started picking up again in the last few weeks. And the other interesting thing that made me think that it was hormonal was that I started getting hot flushes a lot.
Wow.
And I just put that down to coincidence. Well, it's just, I'm moving towards menopause and I just assumed that maybe it had sped that up a little bit. But significant hot flushes, the way you hear people talking about that real furnace flaring up throughout. And I was getting them a lot, very frequently throughout the day. Whereas before, I'd only just started getting them a little bit during the night, early in the morning. And when I stopped, those mostly went away again. They have started coming back, but with the sort of usual progression that you'd expect heading into menopause. But this was, quite a significant, all of a sudden they were there, quite intense, and they did go away again. But none of those things alleviated, really. And I thought maybe it was just an adjustment thing and it would just be for the first couple of weeks. I only managed to do it in the end for about 6 weeks, but none of them got better really. And people suggested I maybe sort of, look at taking things like bile salts for the reflux and things. Mm. My feeling was that if I had to take some kind of supplement to alleviate the problem, whereas just going back more towards keto would solve it, that was indicating that carnivore didn't actually suit me. But I don't know why it went that way, because I really wasn't expecting it to. And I don't know if you've got any ideas on that. I did hear an interview with Doc Nally, and he was talking about some women in particular who are doing carnivore, who if they found it didn't work very well, just needed, say, a small amount of greens every few days. He talked about estrogen sponges and things like that. And that's where I was starting to think about the hormonal element, really, because of the hot flushes. But also I know that my headaches are quite often wrapped up with hormones. I don't know if you've got any theories on why it didn't go according to plan.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm surprised you stuck with it for 6 whole weeks, given all those effects. But given the context of our conversation today, one wonders if the problem isn't that when you went carnivore, your protein levels versus your fat levels just changed to the point where you weren't getting the benefits of ketosis anymore. And especially if you were letting go of butter, which might have been a way to keep the fat levels up. And I don't know, you know, I think a lot of people who are on ketogenic diets and who eat plants, a lot of their fat comes from salad oil or from butter that they put on their vegetables while they're cooking, or more bacon grease or something on their vegetables that way. It seems to me that a lot of people who go from keto to carnivore actually get a lot less ketogenic. Mm. Maybe that was really important to you for the hormonal part of the picture, for the reflux part, and for, I guess I already said the hot flashes would be hormonal. So my question to you is, have you considered trying keto AF?
Yes, I must admit, when I started hearing more about it, you know, hearing April's story and listening to Siobhan when I interviewed her, I wonder if I had been more scrupulous about the macro amount, whether that would have had an effect or not. I know I did very much focus on finding the fattiest meats I could, mm-hmm. but I wasn't adding fat like April did with adding the butter to it or adding some form of animal fat to make sure it was a 2-to-1 ratio. So yes, it probably wasn't, even though I was going for the really fatty cuts as much as I could.
Yeah, I think fatty cuts usually, at least around here, will get you to, well, it depends on exactly how fatty, but sometimes they'll only get you to like a 1-to-1 level.
Yeah, exactly. I think even with the things, I think the fattiest thing I was having were lamb ribs. Mm-hmm. And especially if they hadn't been overly trimmed. I mean, they had big lumps of fat on them. But even that, yeah, you probably weren't going past about 1-to-1 actually.
Yeah. So maybe that's my best hypothesis.
So maybe. What do you think about this whole thing that Dr. Nally was talking about needing some greens? I forget exactly. I should have listened to it again. It was something to do with estrogen and needing the greens to mop up excess estrogen. Not necessarily very much, a small amount every few days, say.
To mop it up in the gut? I guess, to be really honest, it doesn't sound very plausible to me. Mm. Maybe if I listened to his description a little more, maybe there is something that I would say, oh, aha, I see what you mean. But I don't know. I can't think of any reason why that would be the case.
So maybe I need to try again with a keto AF experiment this time. We shall see. But talking of experiments, I believe you're starting one as of today.
Yes, I'm going to do a keto AF style experiment. I have done one once before. I'm not sure if I mentioned this already. I did one back in March, and initially in the first week, I saw a lot of weight loss, and then that all came back while I was still on the Keto AF protocol. But as I was telling you earlier, the protocol was pretty loose. It was really focused on the ratio more than the absolute amounts, and there were a lot of variables in terms of the different foods I was using to get there, and there were times when alcohol was involved, and I just feel like maybe it wasn't well controlled enough to find out. So I've been wanting to do it again, and definitely hearing April's story has been very inspiring in that way. And when I was doing it, I was using only, I wasn't using any dairy at all. So I was eating a lot of just actually chunks of beef or pork fat, and I find them kind of hard to eat when they're cooked, just like April does. And so what I was doing was mostly eating them cold and raw, which was fine. I didn't dislike it, but I didn't love it either.
Yes, I can remember having that conversation with you about it. I think I mentioned to you Riette that we get here a lot, which must be like a 2-to-1 ratio, because you see it when you open the tubs. And they come in different forms, but it's the most common is sort of shredded pork, but all the pork fat is in there as well. And you can see when you scoop it out a lot of it's fat.
Yeah.
I can remember you saying you struggled with it. And, you know, that is a possible kind of food that might work.
Yeah. So one of the things that I'll be using extensively for this experiment that I'm starting today are actually the carnivore bar. I supported the Kickstarter and my bars came in just Christmas Eve, actually, which meant that some people got them in their stockings. But I got enough that I can eat carnivore bars primarily for a few weeks before I would run out. And I also, some people may have heard of the fire in a bottle croissant diet that has been talked about a lot over the last few weeks. The idea behind that is that saturated fat in particular can add to satiety in a way that polyunsaturated fat doesn't. So you could do a 2-to-1 diet that was very high in polyunsaturated fat or not, and those could have different effects. And so in order to help add to the, make sure that the saturated fat is a lot higher, I'll be incorporating some dairy in the form of yogurt and probably also butter. Also some isolated stearic acid that Siobhan actually got for a similar experiment that she's doing. Now, I mentioned this to her. I said I was going to stir some of this stearic acid, which is a saturated fat, into yogurt. And she said that I might find that at that level of stearic acid in that form, I might see that I'm not digesting it very well. And she recommends that I heat it in some form and incorporate it into a food. So I may have to change the specifics of that after a couple of days if I find that it's actually just going right through me. But we'll see.
That'd be interesting.
I could just switch to butter.
Might not want to stray too far from home. Yeah.
Yeah. If it comes to that, I probably will just switch to butter.
That's a whole interesting thing though, isn't it? With, you know, so long fat has been demonized, but particularly saturated fat.
Yeah. And the theory that has been talked about by Peter Dobromilsky and now Brad Marshall is that it's actually the saturated fat that explains the so-called French paradox, for example, that the reason that they're not getting fat on fat is in particular because it's saturated, and that saturated fat gives your cells the ability to signal satiety in a way that polyunsaturated fats don't, and that this increasing level of soy oil and canola oil and all of these other so-called vegetable oils are causing the obesity epidemic or contributing to it because of the exchange of the good, the so-called good saturated fat for the so-called bad unsaturated fat. So it's a really interesting theory. And one thing that I like about it is that on the one hand, it's completely independent of the amount of carbohydrate in your diet, that effect. And on the other hand, it also could be part of the explanation of why a carnivore diet works, because if you're on a low carb diet, but most of your fat in the high fat part of the high fat, low carb diet is coming from salad oil, and then you switch from that to eating almost no polyunsaturated fats, or at least a lot less, and eating a lot of saturated fats where you might not have been before, that could actually be a large part of the account of the difference for some people. So it's interesting. I really like learning about different theories because there are so many, you know, you were talking about the migraine bucket and how there are all these different contributing factors, and it's only when enough of them have built up that you start to see the effect. Mm. Well, the same thing could be true in obesity, certainly, that, you know, if I'm eating 300 carbs a day, but I've got a high level of saturated fat, and I don't know what the other factors might be, but it could be that you could eat more carbohydrates if you got the other factors right. So I think it's really interesting.
It's fascinating, isn't it? And it's also this whole way you were talking about earlier about what lens you're viewing it through. When you just said there, changing the type of fats you're eating could be a huge component that could be underestimated because you're focusing on removing plants.
Right.
And so you haven't even thought about that component, but actually that might be playing a big part in it about why it's successful for you.
Right.
Fascinating.
And no promises, but if this experiment goes well in terms of just it's smooth to do and I don't come up with too many problems in the execution of it, I am thinking about adding a second experiment where I get most of my fat from chicken fat and duck fat, which are much higher in polyunsaturated fatty acids, just to see if that has an effect. But we'll see if I ever get around to doing that.
Well, we were saying earlier that it can be a bit grueling, limiting diets. I mean, some people find it easier, don't they? Just eating in a very restricted way. It kind of does take, I must admit, it wasn't all bad with the carnivore challenge. And taking that, having to think so much about what you were going to have for dinner, taking that out of the equation, well, it's just going to be meat and it's deciding what kind of meat. And actually, I discovered all these different things in the meat department in the supermarket that I hadn't come across before. Like, I didn't know that duck scratchings, as I call them, existed. You know, I know about pork scratchings. I'd never come across gratin, they're called, gratin de canard. Delicious little, it's obviously all the snippets, but the skin and the fat that's been rendered down a bit when they're doing, I imagine, when they're confying the legs.
Wow.
They throw in all these bits and pieces and you get this little box of duck scratchings. Absolutely delicious. So I actually discovered that, you know, you wouldn't think you would, going on such a restricted diet, but actually discovered some new foods that I liked. So that was interesting. And the preparation time, the cooking time, everything just is so much easier and quicker.
Oh, goodness, yes. So
there's a lot of good parts to it too.
I still make vegetable-based dishes occasionally for my children. And the difference in the amount of time it takes to cook them, say, a big soup or stir fry or a curry or something like that, than just throwing a steak on the pan. It's pretty amazing.
It's incredible, isn't it? I had someone round for dinner a couple of times while I was doing the experiment, complained all the time. One, because I wasn't drinking wine. He got cross about that. But also just that I was just eating meat. But the point is that I made other things for him. So some vegetables and things. And that was exactly, so I'd been used to, you know, for a couple of weeks, just this quick and easy preparation. And then having to make some vegetables for him. Yeah, it was just this stark difference. You get used to it, but all of a sudden throwing it in.
Yeah, it can take an extra hour.
It's time consuming.
You should wash and chop and yeah. It makes a big difference. And if you think about that integrated over like a week or a month or a year, how much time are we losing?
Absolutely.
Especially if you don't enjoy it. I do like cooking, but I don't know, every day does add up.
Me too. It's nice to just have quick and easy days. Mention quickly back there, CarnivoryCon, the first one.
Oh, yeah.
This year. We're right at the end of the year now. But great plans for 2020, I gather. It's moving to a two-day event. Is that right?
It is. I'm really excited about it. We're doing it at the end of May. So May 23rd and 24th are the days. It's a Saturday and Sunday. Here, the Monday is a holiday. So we're going to go right late into the night on Sunday. And we're going to have fantastic food. We opened up the speakers for the community to submit talks, and the committee is still going through all the different talks that were submitted, so I can't give away all the talks yet, but I will say that Dr. Georgia Eade and Megan Ramos will be giving invited talks. I think we're just going to have a really great time, and I'm very excited about how well it was received last year that we were able to justify doing it again.
Well, that was my first thought that, I mean, I knew how well it went down because I was there, so I saw the reaction. But for you to be doubling the size of it effectively by doing it for 2 days, that obviously, that told me straight away when I knew it was going to be a two-day event that you've obviously got the demand for it. So that's fantastic.
I hope so. And thank you for mentioning it. I hope that somebody who's listening didn't realize it was going on and now they know.
They do. And I'll certainly be reminding people nearer the time and when tickets come out so that they don't miss out. Will it be in the same place? Will you be having it in the... Because it was a nice venue.
Yes, the Boulder Theatre will be holding it there again. We will be eating there again, but it will be dinner, not lunch.
Ah, right. Interesting. It was delicious food.
Yeah. Black Belly will be returning, but we're also going to have Andrew Justice, who is the feasting expert at the Fasting Method Clinic, for one of the days as well.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah. What was I going to say? The tickets are already on sale. So.
Ah, they are?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And where can people find them?
Carnivorycon.com.
Perfect. We'll put the links in the show notes as well so people can find it easily.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me about all sorts of things. It's been really interesting.
Yeah, it's been a really deep conversation. I appreciate your inviting me to talk about such a fascinating topic because I think there's really something important that we can learn from April's experience. I don't know what it is yet, but there's something there. And when we find out what it is, I think it's going to help a lot of people.
Mm, yeah, me too. I can't wait for that. Perhaps I'm going to spring this on you because I forgot to remind you at the beginning. But I wonder if you could leave us with a top tip.
Top tip. So my top tip, I think, would probably be very similar to what April gave, and that is don't listen to people. You know, if people think that they know the answers. I mean, listen to them, but realize that we're all just going on theories. And sometimes it turns out that we're wrong about stuff. I found it really fascinating that she said that she went from a person who wanted to be told what to do and was encouraged to do some research for herself, and that it really opened up her mind and allowed her to engage with what she was doing in a deep way. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone should do that. And I don't know how that happens, because I know at the beginning, we don't necessarily feel confident and we want to just have an authority say, here's what you have to do so that we don't make any mistakes. But if you do start exploring how these beliefs about what works has come into play, you might be the one who figures out where the flaw in our reasoning is. And so everyone can participate in the science by reading and understanding what the model is. And then if you have a personal experience or you see in someone else something not working, you have something to go on because you've made it something of yours.
I think it's a common thing that people do get interested in why it's working. I think no matter why they start eating this way, be it keto, be it carnivore, and they might even be thinking to themselves it's a bit faddy, but they're going to give it a go as a diet that's, well, now become popularized. But then when they do see how well it works, but going from that to how well they're feeling and having these other surprising benefits that they hadn't thought would happen, you know, different health benefits. I always say that's what keeps people doing carnivore, doing keto. They might come to it from a weight loss point of view, but they stay doing it because all these health things start clearing up and they start feeling so much better. And I think that then sparks this curiosity to find out, well, why is that happening?
Yeah.
And so people start getting interested in the science behind it because they want to know why. Why do I suddenly feel better?
Yeah.
And it just sparks this natural curiosity and people become researchers. And you see it time and time again. It seems to happen a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah. And when you, once you do that, then the world is your oyster because you, it's like if someone says, okay, eat this exact meal on Monday and this exact meal on Tuesday, then you've got something that's very rigid and it might work for you, but you have no ability to make it better for you or more suited to you or to work when you're on vacation. But if someone gives you a carb counting book, then you can say, oh, I know what to do. And the carb count is fundamental to a low carb diet, but there's so much more. And the more you know, the more you can use that knowledge to your advantage.
Absolutely. And once you understand those principles, that's when you can start tailoring it to suit you.
Right.
And that's, of course, when it becomes a lot more easy to stick to, because you're not having to follow somebody else's regime. You make your own.
That's right.
Well, I look forward to hearing how you do on your latest experiment. Won't have to wait long, only a couple of weeks.
That's right. Of course, since I'm so heavily influenced by Siobhan, I'll be doing more blood work and that will take longer to come in.
Of course. And she always loves doing her experiments. So I imagine having that kind of person around is going to inspire you to be doing all sorts of perhaps more experiments than normally you'd be doing.
She's a wonderful
influence. I bet you bounce
influence.
Off each other.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've got some books lined up to read together too. So it's been great.
I bet. Great collaboration. Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Thank you so much, Amber, for talking to me today. It's been a great pleasure as always.
Thank you, Daisy.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman. Or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman Podcast Instagram and Facebook pages and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from Charles F. Glassman. Using someone else's ruler to measure your self-worth will always leave you short. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.